My Word. A panel game devised by Tony Schreyan and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Powell and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton in a game about words. And here's your chairman, Jack Longland.
Well, we go straight into round one, which tests her vocabulary. For 2 marks, what's the meaning of the following words? Beginning with Dennis Norton. Dennis, incubus. I-N-C-U-B-U-S. Incubus.
Incubus. Well, that could be sort of telegram language for standing in a bus queue. It's one of those words, occult, to do with the occult. It's sort of the exorcist type
yes.
area. It's some kind of ghost or a manifestation of evil of some kind that besets you.
I've got to give you one out of two. Originally, this was a demon lover, an evil spirit supposed to descend upon sleeping women, which they might or might not have liked. But by association, this means any worry or guilt that lies heavily, not on you, but on your mind or conscience. One out of two. To this part, supererogation.
Supererogation. That lies very heavily on my inside. I always thought supererogation meant something which was sort of added, which was totally unnecessary.
It's actually something.
A work of supererogation.
That's right. It's certainly added, but it needn't be unnecessary. You're very close to right, but like to try and define a little closer.
It can help.
Yes, it can help. Not necessarily you.
Help the other person.
It will, yes. Quite a lot of other people.
Altruistic addition.
That's it. I think you creep home to your 2 marks. It's the doing of that which is above and beyond the call of duty. And in theology, it means that you build up a credit balance of merit which can be drawn on in favor of other sinners. It's a help, you see. Not necessarily to you, but you can push other people through the wicket gate because you've been doing this. And work of supererogation is exactly as you described.
You're subject to a wealth tax now.
All right, back to Frank now. Frank, yours is machination.
And machination is one of those things which in Victorian times did not long go unobserved by those whom it laboured to deceive.
It's not Sherlock Holmes stuff, is it?
It's kind of plot, isn't it?
Yes.
It's a device to do somebody else in the eye. It's a rather sort of shabby undercover ploy.
Yep, I think I'll do it. Well,
I could go on. Extra mouth.
No need to at the moment, I think. The process of planning or plotting, of conspiring or intriguing, or it can be an intrigue or a plot. 2 marks. Anne Scott James, yours is fustian, F-U-S-T-I-A-N, fustian.
Fustian is a material.
Yes.
Or fabric. Coarse and of a rustic nature.
Yes.
Such as was worn by the rustics in the Midsummer Night's Dream, I think, don't you? Sure, bottom wore fustian.
Well, it would have been, but now they weren't in complete evening dress, if you're expecting. Never mind. You never know. Fustian is a thick, twilled, short nap cotton cloth. It means, by association, pompous or turgid speech or bombastic writing. Well, at this point, I give Frank and Dennis a quotation each to think about for their stories in the last round. And Frank, yours is, I wouldn't leave my little wooden hut for you, ooh.
I've got one lover and I don't want two.
And for you, Dennis, which I think is not all that musical, he who hesitates is lost.
His host, generally.
Well, we can keep that one for the last round. Well, now we have a round about origins and derivations, and for 2 marks again, how did the following words or phrases originate or derive? And we begin with Dennis Norton appropriately. cami knickers.
Oh.
Oh, what fun.
I don't know where it originated, but I can remember where they ended. It's a combination of garments. Knickers. And camisole.
Camisole. All right, lengthen the knickers.
This is getting it more and more tweed.
One and a half. Don't mind it. Cami knickers is a double abbreviation. It's camisole knickerbockers. Camisole was the woman's underbodice or undergarment, whatever you call it. And knickerbockers originally were loose-fitting breeches as worn by the Dutch settlers in New York, gathered below the knee. And once upon a time, that was how knickers were for women, and cyclists wore that, and maybe still do for all I know, as an overgarment rather than an under one. One and a half. We go back to Dennis Powell. Penicillin. Origin and derivation.
Well, origin, it is a kind of fungus.
Yes.
It was covered by, that...
Fleming.
Fleming, and somebody else. Do you know?
Yep.
Frank knows. He knows why it's called penicillin.
Sir, please, sir.
Come on.
It's called penicillin because... because there are pencil-shaped fronds or something involved in it.
Very close indeed, in fact.
Piece of...
your painting thing.
Vegetation. Brush-shaped.
Yeah. All right.
It should be brushicillin.
One. It derives from the Latin penicillus, which was a painter's brush, which is a diminutive of a word meaning a tail. It also means something rather more vulgar, and I won't go on with that.
Oh, go on.
We've had knickers. Not scared by knickers. Have a go, Jack.
And this was suggested by the brush-like, what's called the sporangia, that is the case in which the spores are produced, which is typical of this kind of mold, which luckily not only is a mold, but cures you of things. Penicillin. Frank Muir, a chemosal, or it can be, if you prefer it, S-C-H-E-M-O-Z-Z-L-E, chemosal, but usually chemosal.
Well, muzzle toff means good luck, sir. So she muzzle is lady luck.
The luck bit is right, but qualifies.
In which case, the word is, I imagine, East End London slang.
Yes,
probably
it is.
Jewish.
Quite right, yes. Jewish it is, yes. East End slang, deriving from the German schlimm, which means bad, and the Hebrew mazal, which means luck. And so it used to be schlimozel, with an L in the middle of it. I can't even say it. So it first meant a muddle or complication or bad luck, and then came
to
me. That's right, a rumpus, a to-do, an untidy mess. And
kerfuffle.
So. Yeah. Kerfuffle is a very good one. But where a kerfuffle comes from, I don't know. I haven't got my dictionary.
You didn't ask me that.
That's just as well.
Not
on to Anne Scott James. A tam o'shanter.
Oh, it is a beret. A Celtic beret.
Yes, that'll do.
With a pom-pom on top.
I think that's optional.
Now, we assume it's a Scots word, do we not?
I think quite rightly.
Well, I think tam is an old Scots word meaning top. O means of, and shanter means
it's
head.
It's
what goes on top
over
the head.
That's
Celtic. Healand.
Yes, well, think of the principal poet.
Well, it's Burns, of course, as I was just about to say.
It's a hero of Robert Burns' poem, was called Tam O'Shanter, and the poem says he wore a good blue bonnet, and Tam O'Shanter, as worn by the Scots, was named after him. Well, now we have a round of technical terms. For one mark, to what profession or occupation do these technical terms belong? And for another mark, what's the meaning of the term? We begin with Dennis Norton. V2, rotate.
Well, it's how
a German is telling a girl how to do the waltz.
Very nice.
Is it anything to do with V2, with the time weapon, the V2.
It's in the same...
With yeah. manned projectiles. With
well, you could call it, yes. I hope it won't become that.
with flying. It's something to do with the art of flying.
Yes, that's it.
Yeah, and that's as far as I go. I don't know. I can just about understand a Dodgem car.
It's said by one pilot, probably the second pilot, to the first pilot. Does that help you at all?
No.
No.
Half a mark. It's an airline pilot. It's the cue given by the second pilot to the first pilot during takeoff of an airliner, and it means that the aircraft has reached flying speed, and therefore the first pilot can pull whatever it is, the control column, back and start lifting it off the runway. And rotate means ease back. V2 means velocity 2, whereas V1 means that you're absolutely committed. You've taken off and you can't get back again. V2, rotate. Dennis Powell, Oye, and Termine, O-Y-E-R, and T-E-R-M-I-N-E-R, which may have been usually described even in a less good French accent than mine.
Oye means here.
That's right.
Hear ye.
Yes.
And Termine would mean shut up.
Well, not quite. It might finish with somebody being shut
finish,
up.
Finishing with a voice in the air refers to court.
Yes,
quite
right.
Files.
Yes.
And there's a sort of preamble where
that's it.
Yeah.
And who do you say it to?
To the court itself.
And who's in charge?
The magistrate, the judge. The judge. Sorry.
Magistrate.
Well, yes.
The judge would be better.
The judge.
Well, you fought your way home, I think, then. Oye and Termine belongs to the business of being a lawyer. It's a version of the Anglo-French term meaning to hear and determine, and is commonly included in the preamble, which is read out in court before a circuit judge when he's starting to dispense justice. It's literally a royal commission giving him the power to hear and determine criminal causes. And it goes back to the Norman French law. 2 marks. Frankner, to finish a rabbit with a badger.
Would it be the earlier and truer pronunciation was now called a rebate.
Quite right.
For which you'd use a it's rabat, isn't it? You'd use a rabbit plane.
So absolutely right.
So to get... It means cutting a bit out of a bit of wood.
Yeah, and how are you finishing
not
it off?
Not a slice off, but a bit
right.
out.
And how you... stick to your plane, how are you finishing it off?
Well, you shove your finger in a bit of sawdust and rub it up and down, hopefully.
Yeah, but I'm trying to get the badger.
The badger is obviously one of these things like a weasel in other trades.
Yes, very much like that.
Which is an animal's name applied to a tool, which either looks like a badger or digs deep, which a badger does.
Frank is a very good handyman. He knows a lot about carpentry. The chap who would be doing this, finishing a rabbit with a badger, is a carpenter or a joiner, and as Frank rightly said, a rabbit or rebate is a step-shaped reduction cut along the edge or the face of a length of wood, and it receives the edge or tongue of another bit of wood. The badger was the large, flat-bottomed plane, and it means, therefore, to plane smooth the surface of your rabbit or rebate. And Scott James, and I'll do this in the old pronunciation, though you probably are better at the new, levator labii superioris aliqui nasi. What profession first?
Well, it's all in Latin. It must be the law, I should think.
No, I wouldn't stick to that. Think of that labii.
Lips.
Yeah.
Let's do it. And the nasi of the nose. Is it medicine, is it?
Yes, medicine, right.
Medicine, oh.
And what
the
is
lifter
it?
Of the lips.
Yes. The washer. Is it the
lifter of the lips, that's quite right. Yeah.
Of the superior lips.
That's right, the upper lip.
Of the upper lip.
Mm-hmm. Aliqui, what was aliqui?
Somewhere else.
Well, nasi, you see.
The nose.
What is doing all this? Anna's doing it terribly well. I'm sorry, I'm not
going to do it. What are you doing terribly
well? Well, that which raises the upper lip.
Is
something of the nose.
No, but how do you raise your upper lip?
I have a man in, actually. That comes in. You raise your upper lip. Well, it's a muscle.
That's what I want.
It's
a formal term in human anatomy for a small muscle in the face that lifts the upper lip in a smile or a sneer. Well, I think two. I think you got that. Now we come to the last round, and we go back to those quotations I gave Frank and Dennis at the beginning of the programme. And on this occasion, the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And Frank's quotation was, "I wouldn't leave my little wooden hut for you."
In between the time that this programme is recorded and it is broadcast, my wife and I will celebrate our 25th wedding anniversary, our silver wedding. Now, I don't say that in order for you to send me things. Because if you get hundreds of thousands of silver objects, it means cleaning them and things. So please don't bother. Just forget the whole thing. Gold, of course, doesn't tarnish. Just a thought. The point is that the 25th wedding anniversary is relevant. Because last night I spent an hour and 50 minutes up in our loft. And most of it was spent wallowing in nostalgia. There was a bust of Lord Roberts with an ear missing up there. And there was a moth-eaten dressmaker's dummy. And suddenly I saw in a corner, wrapped up in a whole lot of faded, tatty, almost rotted rope, what seemed to be one of those removable bits of a table, a mahogany bit about 3 foot by 18 inches, with two pegs down one side, removable leaf thing. And that was bound round with a hand-knitted cap thing with a pom-pom on the top. A sort of woolly cap. And I saw those things. And suddenly it all came back to me. They were my total possessions when I was married. And I remember the ceremony terribly well. Church of the Holy Redeemer, Chelsea. Standing there. And Father de Zulueta, who married us, said at one point of the service, "With all my worldly goods, I thee endow." And I had to repeat it. And I paused a fraction and thought, I haven't got any worldly goods to endow this good lady. It's absolutely true. It's just after the war. I had no clothes of my own. I had my D-mob clothes. I had an open car, a clapped-out open car at the time. And you know what you think when you drive a sports car, your hair blows back. You know, marvellous. But the terrible thing which you don't realise is in an open car, your hair blows forward and it sort of lashes your eyeballs as you're trying to drive. So I bought this woolly hat and my fiancé saw it for the first time and said, "You're never to wear that again. You look like a fur-bearing toffee apple." And I put it aside. And the only other thing I possessed was this leaf out of our dining room table at home. My mother had sold the table and forgotten about the leaf. And I thought this was a marvellous thing to have. So my only two things I took to my wedding were this lump of mahogany and this woolly hat with a pom-pom on it. And you know, I never did give them to my wife. Somehow they got stuck up in the loft when we moved home. And my wife said, "What are you doing up there all this time? Your omelette's like an elderly wallet." I said, "I have got something to give to you." I brought them down. I said, "It's things. They've been 25 years coming, but I was supposed to endow you with them 25 years ago. But now, well, here they are. A wooden leaf, my little woolen hat for you."
Well, now we go back to Dennis Norden, and if you remember, his line was a 16th century proverb, "He who hesitates is lost."
I was watching one of those kung fu epics the other night, and the leading character in it made a very profound remark to his closest friend. He said, "The man whose experiences with the opposite sex are unhappy ones never finishes first in the obstacle race of life." Then he kicked his mate in the groin and rode off into the sunset. That I suddenly thought to myself, that could very well account for my own failure to break life's tape ahead of the field. Because my experiences with girls, especially my early experiences, were, to call them gruesome would just be flattery. And that's why, when I was 17, all of romance was summed up for me in a scene from a film called History is Made at Night. Nobody remember that now, but in this scene, Charles Boyer took Jean Arthur to dinner in a restaurant where a strolling violinist leaned over and played a melody into her left ear. And as she listened, her hand crept across the table and she linked her little finger into his. Into Charles Boyer's, I mean, you know, not the violinist, because that would have cocked up the violin playing. I can't tell you what paroxysms of dewy-eyed soppiness that sent me into. If I could only arrange a setup like that for myself, then life would have nothing further it could offer me. Within a month, a new family moved in next door, containing a daughter called Bernice. And the other happy circumstance was that the haberdashers on the parade went bust, and it was reopened. It was reopened as, after some initial difficulties with the neon sign, the Hendon Brasserie. What's more, and this is a strange thing, it was owned and run by an ex-member of the De Broglie Summers Savoy Orpheans. So I had it all now, you see, the time, the place, the girl, and the strolling violinist. So I asked Bernice for a date, and when she met me at the Hendon Brasserie, she looked a knockout. Admittedly, she did appear to be about 2 feet taller than Jean Arthur. Well, that was because Hendon girls of that time were very strong on what were then called beehive hairdos. Anyway, I pushed Bernice through that three-course a la carte in record time, and the moment that coffee was plonked down, I was all set for blast-off. I said to her, "What's your favourite tune?" And I sort of smiled it, you know. "But what's your favourite tune?" You know, sort of did the boy a nose wrinkle. And she said, well, what's the one that goes... And then she hummed a few bars. I said, "That's the national anthem." She said, well, will you pick one? So I said, all right. So beckoning the violinist over, I said, "My good man, do you know, time after time I tell myself that I'm..." And he nodded, winked, and then he leaned forward over Bernice's ear, and he started playing on that low, sexy violin string that they don't seem to use much anymore. Well, say what you like, there is something about those old Hollywood ploys, because he hadn't played more than about 12 bars when I saw Bernice's hand come creeping across the table towards mine, close my eyes in sheer bliss. Such sheer bliss that I didn't even notice when the music stopped. It was only when I heard this strange kind of sawing noise that I opened my eyes again. That idiot was as inexpert at the game as I was. He'd got his bow stuck right through her behind. Well, you know that peculiarly stiff kind of lacquer that girls put on their hair in those days? Well, it had somehow bonded to the rosin on his bow, and it was awful. Her hair was sort of swaying with this... I can't even talk about it now, but it's a good example of that kung fu proverb, isn't it? The man whose experiences with the opposite sex are unhappy ones never finishes first in the obstacle race of life. Or if you prefer it in the Western version, he who has sad dates is last.
I'm glad you could clap through your tears. I thought that was the most pathetic story I'd ever heard. And now, by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Dennis Norden wins the story contest. On the other hand, Phyllis Powell and Frank Muir win the entire My Word contest of this evening.
In My Word, you heard Phyllis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland, with questions compiled by Peter Moore. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.
You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.